supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up, we have another jam-packed show for you cats and kittens. In the question of the week, we will discuss swarming season, when suddenly you may be surrounded by 40,000 bees and like it. We'll also talk about how our soil is going to save us all. That's a lot to get done, so we better hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Sandra, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. I'm happy to be on your show today.
I'm happy to have you here. Sandra, where are you?
I'm in Mount Pocono, Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay. Up on the northeast extension of the Pennsylvania Turnpike. And as all Pennsylvanians know, you live in the imaginary mountains, the Pocono Mountains, which don't actually exist on a map anywhere.
Well, that's probably true, but I can sure see them all around me.
Yeah. What can we do for Sandra in Mount Pocono?
Well, I had this delivery of wood chips, a big truckload that I was going to use in my walkways between all my raised beds. And now that I have it delivered, it is all pretty much composted already. It's been sitting probably for a year, over a year. And I don't think it would be so good to put it in between the beds in the walkways because things might grow in it. But I wondered if I could put these composted wood chips in the beds themselves with my vegetables, you know, to add compost to my vegetable gardens.
That's an excellent question. Now, when you purchase these wood chips, are they what we call arborist wood chips from like a tree trimming service, or are they supposed?
They were from a nursery that was nearby, and when I called about them afterwards, after they delivered them, I wanted to make sure there was no black walnut in them, and they assured me that there was not.
I don't think that's the issue here. Were they dyed in any way? What color were they when they showed up?
No, they were, when I looked at the pile back in February, and they looked like regular old wood chips, you know, just brown wood chips, normal color. But now it's like thick, rich black soil, you know, that's pretty much most of it, and a little bit of woods, pieces of wood, you know, throughout. But mostly, it's like a black, rich soil.
Okay, good. Well, this is what happens. If you pile up wood chips long enough, if the pile's big enough, they're going to compost down, and the compost that results is going to be pretty much of the same quality as if you had done it with shredded fall leaves. Some of my neighbors wanted me to experiment with this after Hurricane Sandy, and they had one of their tree trimmers drop off a triple shredded pile of arborist wood chips and just have me experiment with it, see what happened to it. And it took 2 or 3 years, but it turned into really premium compost. And when I could not find any wood chips anymore in it, I did exactly what you're talking about. I spread it on top of my garden beds for the fresh 2 inches of compost for the season.
Great, great. So I understand that sometimes it turns white. Is that a problem?
Okay, so what they're talking about is during the breakdown process. It starts out with wood, and then fungal organisms in the air combine with the wood to break it down into soil. And a lot of times along the way, you will see streaks of what are called mycelium, which would be the root system of mushrooms and fungi if they had actual roots. So that's just part of the breakdown process, and it's actually a sign that the resulting compost should be very good. Now, what I want you to do, if it's possible, is separate out any big wood chips. Try not to get any big pieces of wood into your garden. But probably the most important thing is do not till this material into the soil. Put it on the surface, because there's going to be little pits of wood in there that are not fully composted. But they're not going to cause a lot of harm sitting on the surface of the soil. If it were a 50-50 mix of compost and wood chips and you tilled it into the soil, then the wood chips would inactivate the nitrogen in your soil and make it difficult for your plants to grow. But if it mostly looks like dirt and you spread it out just on top of the beds, I think it is good compost and you'll have great results with it.
Oh, thank goodness. That's great. Because I was hoping this would be a blessing, you know, instead of something that I would regret having had delivered.
People hear me tirade about wood chips all the time, but if they're not dyed, if they're not altered in any way, if they're just piled up, they turn into super premium compost after time.
Fantastic. That's great. Good, good, good. Okay. Well, I am looking forward to seeing my garden grow amazingly this year with all this.
Well, there's no better food for your plants than compost, so good luck, Sandra.
Okay. Thank you so much, Mike. I appreciate your help on that.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you. You take care now.
Okay. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Tom, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am just ducky today, Tom. How are you, sir?
I'm doing excellent.
And where is Tom excellent?
Tom is from Franklinville, New Jersey, in Gloucester County.
Okay. What exit?
Exit 43.
There you go. Okay. Tom in New Jersey. What can we do you for, sir?
So currently where I live, our house, I have a nice plot of land, about an acre and a half. When I first bought the house, literally before we moved in our furniture, I started breaking into the ground to create a vegetable garden. Doing really well now. It's about like 30 foot by 30 foot. Have a lot of good varieties of vegetables in there. But my problem lies with my mulch beds. And I'm afraid that what's causing problems in the mulch beds is going to go to the garden. I have a lot of voles. And when I say a lot, I mean there are tunnels everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like they maybe come from the mulch bed, but I mean they go out literally into the grass. And I believe that they're voles because of the size of the hole.
Yeah.
And that you can see the tunnels going to the vegetation in the mulch beds to the to the flowers. So,
okay, so two questions for you.
Sure.
Why did you till up your soil instead of just building raised beds on top of it?
There's something about working with the soil directly. It's therapeutic. I work as a guidance counselor.
Uh-huh.
So my mind is busy all day, and it's a different kind of stress as opposed to physical labor. So when I get home, I enjoy getting dirty in the garden.
You
and,
can get just as dirty in a raised bed, Tom.
I agree. I hear you. I hear you.
100%. What I want you to do is make a plan over the coming years, and you've already broken up the subsurface, which is great. But over the years, break that gigantic plot up into 4x8 raised beds and fill them with a good mixture of compost and topsoil.
Sure.
You'll get much better results. You'll get just as dirty, and you won't be spending your entire life pulling weeds instead of eating broccoli. Now, I'm going to yell at you about the mulch. What's the matter? You have to imitate your neighbors?
Well, the mulch was there when we bought the house.
Okay.
One of the first things I did was pull the mulch away from the trees. What I've noticed is that there's so much that there's too much moisture, and you see fungus growing in there, like the devil's fingers coming up.
Mm-hmm.
So I take care of that. Neem oil helps a little bit when I spray that on them. But the voles love to go there.
Yes, yes. Wood mulch is like building a condo for voles. They love living underneath it. They're totally protected from predators, and their actions are just as you described. They will make little trails through the nearby grass as they mm-hmm. come and go, and they will eat the roots of all your underground plants.
Right.
So long term, actually even short term, you're going to get a good hoe, and you're going to hoe away probably about half the depth of that mulch. You never want to have mulch that's deeper than 2 inches, or rainwater can't get through to the plants. All the moisture is going to stay trapped on the surface. So you want to slowly hoe that away. The thinner you can make it, the fewer voles you will have over time as predators take them out. If you want to accelerate the process, there's a couple of things you can do. You can go out and get a castor oil-based mullein vole repellent. And after you remove half the chips, let's say, then spray the mullein vole repellent on the remainder. Really saturate it. Really soak it so that those wood chips smell to the voles like castor oil. Then you want to go out and get a bunch of battery-powered mouse traps. These are the bee's knees. Instead of the old snap traps, they have an electrified plate inside that you bait with peanut butter and you put in a couple of AA batteries or something.
Okay.
But they have a light on the outside, a green light to show you it's working and a red light to show that you have an X vole inside. Every time you see the red light on, you dump them out. And if you want to go for the gold, put up a couple of raptor perches. These are simple cross beams, just 6 feet off the ground, and owls will perch on them at night. Owls are the number one predator of voles, and voles are mostly nocturnal. So if you have these raptor perches up, you may never see the action, but in the morning you'll see all the different owl pellets underneath the raptor perches that show you that this natural predator is taking care of the problem.
Okay, great. It sounds like a plan. I appreciate you taking time to take my call.
It's our pleasure. I know there's a lot of work to do with a new house, so just practice the ethic of constant improvement.
And raised beds.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
All right, good luck, Tom.
Take care.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind homeowners who want a safe and sane lawn to get a new blade for their mowers or to get the old one sharpened. Really, the first step to good grass is a sharp cut. But don't go reaching for your sharpening stone just yet, because we'll be right back with the healing power of soil, what to expect when bees are swarming, and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 140th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, what could be wrong with 40,000 bees covering a crepe myrtle? Absolutely nothing. We'll tell you why when we get to the question of the week. We'll also take more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it's time to welcome our special guest, David Montgomery, author of the new book, Growing a Revolution, Bringing Our Soil Back to Life. David, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Yeah, well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you here, David. And now, you are a professor in real life at the University of Washington in Seattle, and you are a professor of a very interesting word or phrase, not just geology. Give it out to us, man.
It's geomorphology, which is the surface features of the Earth. So 100 years ago, I would have been called a topographer, perhaps, but a geomorphologist studies what shapes the part of the world that we walk around on.
you've written a lot of books on dirt, on soil, on the importance of a healthy soil to a healthy planet. If you know anything about me and this show, you know, soil are us. And obviously, being a professor of geomorphology, I feel like I should genuflect, it's a very important topic to you. But, I mean, this is like your fifth book about this, right?
Well, you know, it's my fifth book, but only a couple of them are about soil. The first one was about an environmental history of salmon, and the second one was about the way that farming practices back through history had limited the lifespan of civilizations, and that's how I got into writing about dirt and soil, is looking at the archaeology of how soil degradation had influenced human societies. And then I took a bit of a side trip to write a book about the history of science and religion, and then got back into looking at the way microbial life influences the health of soil and also human health, the sort of the plant microbiome and the human microbiome and the parallels between them. And I wrote that with my wife, who's a biologist. And then the new one, Growing a Revolution, returns to the soil theme and looks at how to build healthy, fertile soils as a consequence of agriculture, taking some of the insights that we came up with in The Hidden Half of Nature and trying to apply them to globally.
Now, I think it's interesting that one of your earlier books talks about how improvements in agriculture had a bad tendency to starve people to death. I don't think people understand that so much, but plowman's folly. If there's one thing I've tried to hammer on this show for 20 years and as editor of Organic Gardening magazine for seven before that, it's stop tilling.
Yeah, that is a very simple and powerful and important message. And if there's a one sentence summary of my dirt book, that's it, because that really is the important message. And when we think of farming, often we go there as sort of the iconic symbol of farming, the plow. It's on the great seal of the USDA. Why did that lead to calamity for society after society if their farmers had used that method over the long run? I like to use the analogy to help explain that of, you know, how many times have you gone out into a native grassland or a natural forest? How much bare soil do you see? You don't. Nature covers herself, clothes herself in plants. And there's this process of, you know, the biology and the microbes in the soil and the plants producing organic matter together create an environment where both prosper and it keeps the soil covered. A plow undoes all that by turning the earth and leaving the soil bare and vulnerable to wind and rain for until the next crop comes in or until the weeds come back. Erosion can race ahead of soil production, and if that happens over decades to centuries, you can quite literally strip the topsoil off a landscape, and you end up with an environment like modern Syria or Libya, two places where Roman tax records document really productive wheat harvests that now you could barely grow anything because the soil is literally gone. It's a major theme in the course of human history that we don't teach, people aren't really exposed to it, and yet it's there, hiding in the history books and in the archaeology for anyone to appreciate, but it's a long-term message. And that's what I'm so excited about with this new book, is that I think there's ways to undo that damage and to restore fertility to the land and to maintain it even as a consequence of farming. But as you were saying, the first step is ditch the plow.
Yeah. And when my producer was actually surprised when I said that I wanted to have you on the show, because obviously your book addresses the large-scale problems of agriculture in America and the world. But when I read what you were doing, it was quite clear that these are the same messages that small-scale backyard gardeners can use to prosper.
Well, you know, and actually that's the environment in which I started to come around to seeing the kind of methods and techniques that the farmers I then visited for Growing a Revolution were using, is the way that my wife, who's a gardener, restored our lot in North Seattle. We live in an area that has just horrible natural soil. Once you strip off the native topsoil and get down to the glacial till that a lot of Seattle is buried in, or made of, shall we say, we had just horrible soil when we bought our place. And she gradually restored it, and I saw what she was doing and how effective it was in reversing the kind of processes I was writing about in the dirt book. And that led us on this path of discovery to ask the questions of, well, how could we restore fertility so fast to this urban lot? And that led us to the role of microbial life, all the fungi and the bacteria in the soil, and think about what as a gardener we were doing that was cultivating the beneficial life that was then in turn supporting the botanical life that we wanted in the garden. And then we took those same principles out to a larger scale to ask in the new book, can it work on really large farms? Can it work on subsistence farms in Africa? And what I think the common message is whether you're in a garden or whether you're on a small farm trying to feed your family or a really large commodity farm in North America, the practices that cultivate the beneficial life in the soil, that get the biology working for you rather than trying to work against the biology in the soil, is really the smart way. And, you know, one of the things I learned in writing Growing a Revolution that I had no idea of at the start, and that's one of the fun things about writing books, is you get to sort of pursue ideas and you don't really know where they're going to lead you when you start, and you only know what you're going to write, the book's about by the time you finish it. Sort of the godfather of the fertilizer industry, Justus von Liebig, a German gentleman who in the 1840s sort of realized that if you add certain elements to the soil, it can promote plant growth, and that our whole sort of agrochemical view of fertilizers grew out of his experiments. At the end of his life, at the end of his career, about 20 years after his famous book that people still mostly know about, he wrote another book that argued that the real key to maintaining fertile soil was recycling organic matter, because if you only added one or two elements, just nitrogen, say, or phosphorus, for example, that you weren't giving the plants all they needed. They're not getting the full buffet of nutrients they need. So they might be able to grow big, but they wouldn't be healthy.
Right. This is the guy who burned a whole bunch of leaf matter, analyzed what was left, and decided, well, this must be what the plants need to grow. Hence came chemical fertilizer salts. And how amazing that at the end of his life he got religion and went, you know what, I was wrong.
Yeah. And so we're in this wonderfully ironic situation today where the intellectual godfather of what we now call conventional farming probably wouldn't think that what we did for most of the 20th century was that great an idea in the big picture of things.
One of the reasons I wanted to have you on very much, and this may have even been a reaction to your book, but just recently, the Philadelphia Inquirer ran the editorial. I don't know which newspaper it began in, but it was something I hadn't seen since the 80s or 90s, saying that if organic was the only farming that was allowed, we'd all starve to death and a loaf of bread would cost $463. And I thought we were so far beyond that.
Yeah, in framing the book, somewhere in one of the first few chapters, I identify a couple of the key myths of modern agriculture, and that's one of them. And
actually, I know where that study came from. Do you know the story of it?
Well, there's a number that have looked at just sort of broad comparisons of organic versus conventional, but they're really fairly misleading comparisons, and I go into a lot of that in the book. But no, fill me in.
The one that I found, the one that I challenged directly, was a couple of professors from Texas who got a grant to study conventional versus organic. And the grant said that they would study the methods used on like three or four conventional farms and the yields and the costs, and then they would compare that to similar sized organic farms. And they got the grant, and then what a shock, suddenly they ran out of time, even though there was no deadline on the grant. So they used the information from the conventional farms, but then asked the conventional farmers to estimate what would happen on the organic farm. So,
oh man,
this was the poster child for bad science.
No, that is terrible. Yeah, and you know, there's a number of studies that have done sort of the meta studies, where a study of studies, where they sort of look across studies and try and make that comparison. But one of the things that I've looked at in Growing a Revolution was visiting farmers who had been very successful at restoring fertility to their soil and interviewing them about, well, what happened to their yields, what happened to their costs, what happened to their profits. And across the board, what I found was that if they adopted a set of practices that sort of cultivate the life in the soil and regenerated the fertility of their land, they were able to greatly reduce and in some cases eliminate their use of agrochemicals while keeping their yields either where they had been under conventional or increasing them.
Well,
a couple of them had had a couple-year dip in yield as they started to restore their soil. But others argued that—
That's because they didn't know what to do yet.
That was a point that one of them made, that now that he's figured out how to manage his rotations, he felt that he could start and have barely any dip in yield in the first year of a transition.
Yeah. I'm sure you're familiar with the mega study of mega studies in 1991, the National Academy of Sciences, that compared conventional farming to organic farming and made no one happy with the results, so it had to be true. And the conclusions were that organic farming produces just as much food of just as good quality on exactly the same amount of land for exactly the same amount of money. The difference being that the, quote, conventional farm was spending a lot of their money on chemicals, and the organic farm was spending a lot of their money on the extra labor that it took, you know, to keep the soil alive, to add organic matter to the soil, to walk the fields, to look for problems before they got out of hand. And I thought, geez, not only does this, you know, destroy a lot of myths, but it also means that more people are being employed.
Yeah. And one of the things that I write about in the new book is looking at how by adopting the suite of practices that can then help rebuild soil fertility, which what I found that applied across the board was minimizing soil disturbance, so ditching the plow, integrating cover crops and legumes in particular, but keeping the ground covered and having nitrogen-fixing crops in there and having others that you use to help rebuild soil carbon levels, and then also diversifying rotations. Those three things, so you had at least three or four crops in a sequence and not just corn, soy, which really isn't a rotation. The farmers who had adopted those three principles, all of which cultivate the life in the soil, and each one of which is a complete reversal of the philosophy of modern conventional farming. But if you adopted that full set of three practices, they not only maintained their yields, but they drove their input use through the floor without huge labor increases. And they were actually far more profitable than their conventional neighbors. So I came to start calling these farmers organic-ish because they had figured out a way to so build the fertility of their soil that they could move their formerly conventional operations much closer to the world of organic agriculture. And some of them went all the way. Some were culturally opposed to doing so. It's a complex issue. But they had so reduced their chemical input use that their farms became much more profitable. And I see that as a way to help revitalize the economic vitality of small farms in America, which getting more people back on the land with the ability to make a good living would really help solve a lot of problems in rural America.
But organic farming will starve the world, David.
I found no evidence that that would be true in researching the new book, with the one exception that if you had sort of full-on tillage-based farming on hillsides that destroyed the soil the way that farming practices helped bring down the Roman Empire and the Greeks and Easter Island, among others— in that case, you could make that argument because the farming practices that were erosive that did in ancient societies, they were all organic. They predate agrochemical agriculture. So the real trick this time around, I think, and which gives lie to the idea that organic would lead to starvation, is if you combine all these practices, the ancient wisdom of cover cropping and of crop rotations, of diversifying our rotations, and diversifying what we eat, frankly, would be better for us as well. Merging that with no-till practices in ways that do not require the great use of herbicide that is typically goes with no-till. And many of the farmers I visited had adopted practices that got their herbicide use, you know, down to almost nothing. This is where the real opportunity lies, I think, to transform what we now call conventional agriculture into something that is far closer to organic. And the question I put to some of these farmers was, well, if you've basically almost reduced your chemical use to nothing and you're more profitable, why not just go that extra step and take the price premium that you can get for calling your produce organic?
And a lot of them are probably, in one sense, beyond organic. That sounds like anybody who's doing really complex cover cropping and really intense soil improvement, they're really making this a better place. They're making America great again.
Yeah, they're making our soil great again. And I think Beyond Organic really is the right concept for that. And if you prioritize thinking about soil health and building the health and fertility of the soil, there's circumstances where a little bit of fertilizer, might actually help with building soil carbon, for example. It's a whole different lens if you think about the health and fertility of the soil as what you're trying to build, and that our agricultural edifice rests upon healthy, fertile soil. The things we could do to rebuild that really are an investment, the great American infrastructure investment that we all should be agreeing on, whether we're in the Blue Citadel cities on the coast all wanting our organic produce, or we are in the great swath of red between the coasts where we're concerned about economic opportunities. Reinvesting in the infrastructure of our soil at a national level is something that would benefit everybody.
And national starts with local. Do it in your own backyard.
Yep.
Sell the tiller exactly. On eBay, make more compost, diversify your crops, learn about cover cropping, which is something I need to do. David Montgomery is the author of the new book, Growing a Revolution, Bringing Our Soil Back to Life, from the Norton Publishing Company, and he is a professor of geomorphology at the University of Washington in Seattle. David, thanks for being on the show today.
Thank you. It's fun to talk to you.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind homeowners who want a safe and sane lawn to follow good cultural practices. That means if you have a cool season lawn, a bluegrass or fescue, never cutting it below 3 inches. No matter what kind of grass you have, leave those nitrogen-rich clippings on the nitrogen-hungry turf. And never, ever cut a lawn when it's wet. But don't go looking for that big blow dryer from the 80s just yet, because we'll be right back to talk about the strangeness of swarms and more of your strange phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 140th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're on the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we will get to the strangeness of swarms, combining questions and reports from all the way up in Ontario down to Fredericksburg, Virginia, of similar strange things happening that involve thousands and thousands of honeybees. What should you do if a swarm you encounter? We'll let you know after a couple more of your swarming phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Lee, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am just Ducky Lee. How are you doing today?
I'm fine. I'm in McGregor Bay, Ontario.
Okay, very good. Up there in Canada, what can we do for Lee in Ontario?
I have a problem with chives. We purchased this property. Mind you, we are on a 12-acre island, and the 5 acres that the house is on is mostly granite. And the people who lived there before planted chives, and they thought that they would be very pretty if they were in various places. I now have areas that are 30 by 15 with nothing but chives, other areas that are 8 by 10, nothing but chives, and various clumps all over the place. I have tried various methods, none of which have worked. First, I tried cutting off the seed heads in the spring. I did that for 3 years. They just got thicker.
Uh-huh.
Then I tried little individual experiments to see what might work, just in a small patch. I tried Roundup. That didn't work.
Okay. Now, I have to stop you and chide you.
Oh.
You're obviously in an aquatic area. Roundup is not licensed for use near any kind of water, and it's deadly to amphibians like frogs and toads.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't work, right?
Well, I only used it in a little tiny place to see what would happen, and no, it didn't work.
Yes. These herbicides are great at killing everything but weeds. But I apologize for jumping on you, but I need to tell as many people as possible, as often as possible, not to use any of these herbicides near water. I mean, if you read the label, it'll warn you not to.
Yeah.
I personally don't think you should use them anywhere, but especially I know the area where you are, and it's ecologically beautiful, and you want to keep your amphibians.
It is.
Okay.
Yes.
So, anyway.
Then I tried a little bit another tiny little 2x3-inch area. I tried vinegar.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that didn't work either.
Okay, so we don't need to go through all your failures, or I'll start recounting my failures. What's going on here is that chives like wild onions, wild garlic,
mm-hmm.
Star of Bethlehem, they have an underground bulb, and that bulb stores a lot of energy. You're also mm-hmm. in a fairly wet environment, which dilutes the effects of any kind of, let's just say, herbicide in general, which would include the natural ones like vinegar and iron. So it's very tough to get any kind of concentration. So the only thing I know of that works really well on these kinds of, quote, weeds is a device called the water-powered weeder. Or
really?
Something similar. Yes, this has been around for years and years. Lee Valley Tools.
I know Lee Valley Tools.
Okay, so in every catalog, you're going to see a picture of their water-powered weeder. And you hook it up to your garden hose. It's got a long spike on the end that, you know, that thins the water down to a laser-like focus. And you stick this in the ground next to a clump of chives, and you hit the trigger. And that clump will be loosened up, maybe even come out of the ground. You pull it, and then you do what you want. But the whole issue here is, what are you going to do with the land once the chives are gone?
Nothing. It's rock, and I like looking at rock.
Oh, I see. Well,
I mean, I'm talking granite here.
Yeah, no, I understand. But they're going to keep coming back if you don't plant something else in their place. But
I see what you're saying.
Yes, obviously things can grow there. And whenever you remove a plant, if you don't plant something else to replace it, nature will do that for you. So if you really want to do this, the first thing you do is research some nice ground covers, something like creeping thyme that can grow between the rocks but still show them off. And then as mm-hmm. you remove each section of chives, you replace it, you replant it heavily. You have the thyme in time, so to speak. You have it in hand, and as soon as you get a patch out, you replace it with your wanted a ground cover plant, and that will give you kind of what you want. Now, there is another simple alternative. Are you in an area with other people?
No, there's no one else on our island.
Nobody else on your island, so you can't put up a sign that says free chives, pick your own.
Oh, no, I've tried giving them away.
Well, that's the answer, is water pressure. But I tell you, is there a restaurant on the mainland or something where you could try to talk to?
The mainland's 10 miles away by boat.
Oh, by boat. Yeah, okay. So, yeah.
It's boat access only.
Yeah, no, I visited many places in Alaska that are very similar. So that's your answer then, water pressure and fast replanting. You want to buy a boatload, of something like creeping thyme and have it ready. And if you do that and take your time and work these patches, you'll eventually be able to replant it to what you want.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Thanks.
Good
Bye-bye.
Luck. 1-888-346-9499. Carol, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. We're 50 miles north of Tulsa, and everything is just wonderful here.
All right. Well, what can we do for Carol in Oklahoma?
I'm wondering why the inoculant I bought for beans and peas specifically says not for use on soybeans. Is there something funny about soybeans that excludes them from use of inoculants?
What a great question, and what a great time of year to be asking it. A little late for peas, of course, but still plenty of bean planting time. You can grow any legume without the help of a, quote, inoculant, which is a naturally occurring soil-borne bacteria. But if you spring for the inoculant, which looks like a little black powder, it almost looks like the old school black powder that they would use in an early firearm, and you roll your dampened seeds in it, and you plant those pea or bean seeds, then what happens is as the roots of the seed come out, they meet the inoculant, and the inoculant gives those roots special abilities so that then the plant itself can take plant feeding nitrogen right out of the air. And you'll be able to tell that the inoculant was either fresh or took, or that the symbiotic effect happened perfectly, because at the end of the season, when you pull up those plants, you'll see little nodules on the roots of those plants. And those nodules contain the symbiotic relationship that allows that plant to use that bacteria to literally feed itself from our atmosphere, which is so cool. When you think about it, most of the air we're breathing is nitrogen, and plants need nitrogen. But most plants don't have the natural ability to take it out of the air. And certain soils have these naturally occurring soil organisms present naturally. Some researchers feel that they're very common, but farmers, gardeners who really want to ensure success, they spend money, a little bit of extra money, to get the inoculant to make sure that they get that extra plant feeding boost, you know, because when you've got the inoculant around the roots of your plants and they're kind of feeding themselves, you don't have to feed the plants as much or anything else. And it is a common inoculant for both peas and beans, which are very closely related. They're members of like the same genus of the same plant family. However, soybeans, which are also legumes, are not members of that family. They are members of a very distinctly different family, a much smaller family. So the soil inoculant for peas and beans would not harm the soybeans, but it won't inoculate the roots of soybeans. For that, you need a specific inoculant that is a different soil-dwelling organism that works only on soybeans and that conversely would not work for peas and beans. So if you're a farmer and you're growing soybeans commercially, you're buying the soybean inoculant. But were you to use that on like your truck patch for string beans, it wouldn't have any effect, positive or negative. It's just different organisms.
Well, the soybean packet asks you to inoculate them. It just doesn't hip you to the fact that you have to use something really different for them.
Yes. Well, and you don't have to inoculate them. The soybeans will grow without that symbiotic relationship. But you will get many more soybeans. The plants will be healthier. You won't have to feed them as much if you spring for the inoculant. But yeah, they are two different substances. So if you're growing peas and beans, that's one packet. If you're growing soybeans, that's another packet.
All right. Mystery solved. Thanks, Mike.
Oh, thank you, Carol. That's a great question.
And thanks for taking up the cause of the invertebrates of the world, the insects and the frogs and the toads.
I love my frogs and toads, and I love my native bees more every day. I've been sitting outside just watching them buzz around. It's just one of my favorite things.
Yeah, put up a piece of rotten fruit and see them all show up.
Well, we do that anyway. We sometimes leave our dinner outside.
All right, bye-bye, Mike.
Bye-bye. All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week, which we're calling, Are You Full of Bees? It must be swarming time. Alexis Landis, get us started off with this week's startling question.
I'd be happy to, Mike. Anne in Ontario, just west of Toronto, writes, We're a horticultural society that runs a community garden. We suddenly have lots of wasps in the garden, especially by the edges and mulched pathways. Can you help with identification and a way to eliminate them? We do not like to kill bugs, but there are children walking in this area and people actively gardening. Thank you so much. Mike, you've already revealed in your headline that these are bees and not any kind of wasp. How did you figure out that they weren't yellow jackets? That's what I thought when I read about them being in the mulched pathways.
Well, it's the right kind of venue for yellow jackets, but it's the wrong time of year. Yellow jacket colonies don't become large enough to be evident until much later in the season, late July through September. At this time of year, the yellow jacket queens that made it through winter are just starting to build new nests. Sure, you'll see a couple of stray yellow jackets here and there, but not anywhere the numbers of insects that invaded Ontario. Now, before I opened up the photo they sent, I did suspect it might be blue-winged wasps, like the ground-nesting native bees that appear in the spring. These big wasps can hover by the hundreds over a very small section of garden.
Ah, like a whole bunch did at the Salvation Army Croc Center Garden in North Philly you helped create a few years back.
Oh, yeah, that was quite an experience walking through a horde of large hovering insects. But they were as docile as could be. Anyway, it's also kind of early in the season for them as well. Right now, you're more likely to see the ground-nesting native digger bees we just mentioned. These native pollinators are solitary bees, meaning that each female has her own little nest. But hundreds of them often nest right next to each other in a fairly small section of bare soil or a piece of a ratty lawn. You know, we get a lot of calls about ground nesting bees in the spring.
Oh, yeah, and it's so nice to be able to assure people that they're just harmless pollinators that don't sting and that will soon vanish for the season. They'd be great to have near a community garden as they'd provide an amazing amount of pollination early in the season. So, if there hadn't been a photo attached, would ground-nesting native bees been your best guess?
Absolutely, especially since I'm somewhat unfamiliar with the behavior that was shown in the photo, which we'll post with this question of the week. It shows what seems to be a cluster of honeybees swarming over a pathway of wood chips on the ground.
Honeybees crawling on the ground?
Yep, it turns out that there's no telling how a swarm will act when it touches down.
Swarm being a definitive word here, correct?
Absolutely, and I was reminded of the terminology by a story that ran the very same week I got that Canadian email. The story ran on WTOP, the news radio station in Washington, D.C.
Where, full disclosure, you have been the garden reporter since 1999.
Absolutely. Now, TOP reported that a woman in Fredericksburg, Virginia, called 911 to report a swarm of bees 3 to 4 feet tall on her crepe myrtle. Despite initial skepticism, responders found a swarm of honeybees 3 to 4 foot high on her crepe myrtle. These swarms happen in the spring. When a queen escapes a beehive, summer all of the workers follow her, and she attempts to set up an independent shop nearby.
Freebies!
Yes, indeedy. That swarm in Virginia was captured by a local beekeeper who estimated the size of the colony at around 40,000 bees. He reports that they transferred nicely and acclimated well to one of his own hives. And even though that story came out after I had answered the email, that's exactly what I had urged the Ontarians to do. Contact a local beekeeper to come out, evaluate, and remove the colony, because unfortunately honeybees do sting.
Especially if they're swarming on the ground, like the image from Ontario showed.
That was one of my big concerns. The swarm in Virginia was up on a crepe myrtle branch. And despite the fact that there were 40,000 bees on it, nobody got stung. Not the homeowner, the curious neighbors, or even the beekeeper who moved them. And that's not surprising. Honeybees aren't aggressive. Most stings happen when somebody in bare feet accidentally steps on one, and researchers feel that the members of a swarm are less aggressive in general.
So what did the Canadians do?
Well, they followed my suggestion and called a beekeeper who advised them to wait a few days to see if the swarm would move on its own. If the bees stayed, the keeper said she'd come back and try and remove them.
Actually, I would want to find a way to keep them.
Absolutely. The ideal situation here would be to move them into an on-site beehive so the community garden can enjoy their pollinating magic. Swarm in the hive is worth two in the mulch. Well, that sure was some interesting information about swarming season, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to swat my swarm if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please be sure to include your location, especially if you're absolutely certain that we don't need it. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where nobody cares about your location and where you'll find the answers to all those garden questions you were going to ask us, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Rich Banowitz and Larissa Sapko keep our website swarming. Our own escaped queen, Alexis Landis, produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our editor, Al Banks, says, "Where's the king? Why didn't anybody talk about the king?" Our production assistant, Brett Rader, is a prince. I'm the king of my castle, Mike McGrath, and I'll dodge that rolling pin and frying pan so I can swarm back and see you again next week. You say cantaloupe, I say muskmelon. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss the misnaming of tropical melons and what it takes to grow these tasty treats of summer. Plus, the plant science in your backyard and your fabulous phone calls.